is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Tax revenues are important because, you know, that's the way you capture the rate of return on all the investment. So you build a road, you build an electric power station. It's important that you find ways in which you are able to repay the loans that you've taken towards that. And our countries, we've not done enough of a good job, you know, in terms of mobilizing tax revenue.
That was Ababa Amaro Selassie, the head of the International Monetary Fund's African Department, on how COVID-19 and Russia's invasion of Ukraine has affected African countries' debt load. Details coming up. Also, the remains of Congolese independence hero Patrice Lumumba has arrived in the DRC after 61 years. But first, our top story. Foreign donors cut off aid to Sudan after the military overthrew the Joint Civilian-Military Transitional Government on October 27th. The cut in aid, which accounts for 40% of state revenues, prompted military leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan to agree to the so-called Troika talks process earlier this month, which included the United Nations and Eastern African Regional Grouping, IGAD. But the French news agency AFP reports the talks have been undermined by a boycott of established political parties as well as groups born out of the mass protests that led to former dictator Bashir's ouster. The African Union, which suspended Sudan after the military overthrow, also has said it will not be a party to talks that exclude significant actors. Since United States envoys failed to persuade the opposition civilian groups to give the talks a chance, the process has been put on hold indefinitely. Belgian authorities have returned a tooth of murdered Congolese independence hero Patrice Lumumba to his children in a new move towards recognition of atrocities that accompanied Belgium's brutal exploitation of its former colony. The relic is all that remains of Lumumba, the first prime minister of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The gold-capped tooth was handed over in a light blue case to a group of family members at the Egmont Palace in Brussels on Monday morning. It has arrived in the DRC today. Jean-Jacques Lumumba, an activist and recipient of the International Award for Fighting Corruption, is the grandson of Patrice Lumumba. He talked to me from Paris today about the return of the remains.
You know, I prefer to talk about the Patrice Lumumba's body remains, his mortal remains, but not the tooth, because it brings back to me his heinous and horrible act. You know, I feel a lot of emotions, and I talk of two companions, Maurice Mpolo and Victor Okito, his wife, Pauline Opango, and his son, Patrice Lumumba, both died in 2014. Lumumba family, who suffered exile, repression in name of their brother, we would have all wanted to see this day filled with emotions. But it's tough for the Congolese people, for whom the death of Lumumba and his comrade Mpolo and Okito represent the beginning of the cycle of impunity, of the down of our succession to independence until today.
So what do you think? What is the significance of returning the remains? Is Belgium trying to put behind one of the most brutal and shameful episodes in the country's bloody exploitation of Central Africa?
You know, this event is only the beginning of the clarification of this process. The apologies of the King Philip and the Prime Minister De Croo, whom we salute, cannot replace the role of justice today.
Yes, you said a crime has been committed, and a great crime was committed in the assassination of your grandfather and a few others in 1961. So, you know, it's very hard to express it to you, but he was killed, dissolved his remains in acid, and kept his tooth as a memento. Will there ever be justice for this grisly deed? Will the family together demand justice?
I insist about justice for men, because justice is the only useful option to build a bright future. You know, the memory of our million of victims of yesterday and today deserve us to be respected and to be honored. Congolese like justice and Lumumba family like justice.
That was Jean-Jacques Lumumba, the grandson of murdered Congolese independence hero Patrice Lumumba, speaking with me from Paris today. Are African countries carrying too much debt? And how will a country debt burden affect its ability to cope and recover from the current global economic crisis? The head of the International Monetary Fund's African Department, Abebe Amorosillase, says the COVID-19 pandemic battered economies everywhere and that food and fuel shortages, due in large part to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, has only made things worse. Heidi Adams, host of VOA Straight Talk Africa, sat down with Amorosillase at the IMF's headquarters here in Washington to discuss the impact of the global economic downturn on African economies.
I'm glad you brought up the pandemic, because of course it saw countries around the world spend significant amounts of money in 2020, especially to combat the effects of the pandemic. And that meant that the debt levels increased worldwide. We saw Zambia, for instance, default in 2020. In your view, are African countries right now carrying too much debt, given the situation we've come out of or are sort of coming out of, and given the situation we are currently in globally?
I think even before the pandemic, what we had seen was countries that have been pursuing quite a lot of investment projects, infrastructure investment, health, education, quite a lot, you know, borrowing to invest in these areas, but not doing as well in terms of collecting tax revenues. Tax revenues are important because, you know, that's the way you capture the rate of return on all the investment. So you build a road, you build an electric power station. It's important that you find ways in which you are able to repay the loans that you've taken towards that. And our countries, we've not done enough of a good job, you know, in terms of mobilizing tax revenues. So reflecting that, debt levels had gone up in many countries. And then you have, of course, have the effects of the pandemic. What that did, of course, was it dampened economic activity, it hit tax revenues, and required governments to spend more. So debt levels went up another notch in the vast majority of countries. As a result of this, some countries have gone into a default situation, or, you know, the risk of debt vulnerability has gone up in a lot of countries. And as you said, countries like Zambia, Chad is another one, had to turn to their creditors and seek debt restructuring. And because African countries, because, you know, we have limited alternative access to capital markets, domestic markets are weaker, you know, the type of resilience mechanisms that many other countries have in the advanced world and large emerging markets, the debt situation is more acute in our countries than it is elsewhere. But again, even within this context, it really is important that, you know, the situation of whether debt is sustainable or not is a fairly dynamic one, a country-specific one, and one that depends on the economic outlook.
And you can catch more of Heidi's interview with Abebe Amorosillase on Straight Talk Africa, which airs today. Rival sides in Libya's long-running conflict concluded their latest round of United Nations-led talks without a deal on rules for long-delayed elections. Representatives of the Tripoli-based High Council of State and of the parliament, based in eastern Libya, began meeting in Cairo more than a week ago that ended Monday without success. Stephanie Williams, the UN's top official in Libya, urged the two sides to meet again within 10 days to bring outstanding issues. Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed the consequences of these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
In February, the House of Representatives and the High Council of State agreed already about the constitutional basis for elections, the so-called 12th Amendment to the Constitutional Declaration from 2011. This was a precondition for the HCS members during these mediations for them to accept the designation of Fateh Bashagha as a prime minister. A little bit later, the opponents of this agreement and of Bashagha as a prime minister within the HCS succeeded, and the HCS as such rejected the whole deal. This is when Stephanie Williams jumped in and more or less forced the Cairo negotiations on the House of Representatives. While the High Council of State readily accepted to renegotiate in Cairo, they've discussed the flawed 27th draft constitution and reached an agreement on about 190 out of 220 articles, excluding almost all the hot issues. It's extremely unlikely that the renewed meeting between the chairs of both bodies will lead to any different outcome. The consequence of all this is that the February compromise is finally entirely gone. While there is no agreement on the draft constitution, no good news for Libya, but no surprise, the situation is more complicated than before. Libya needs an entirely new approach to get at least an interim constitution.
A group of members of the High Council of State, aligned with the Prime Minister designate of the Parliament, Fateh Bashagha, are demanding the incumbent Prime Minister, Abdelhamid Dbeibah, to hand over the government headquarters smoothly, arguing that the term of the government of national unity expires on June 21st this year, according to the Libyan political roadmap set in Geneva last year. How would Dbeibah and militias backing him respond to this?
Actually, these demands are mainly from the HCS members who negotiated the February deal with the HOR. This is now a new attempt by them to get what was agreed rightly in their eyes between them and the HOR, namely the replacement of Dbeibah by Bashagha, what would be probably a good solution for Libya, I would say. However, I don't see any realistic chance that Dbeibah will resign because of these demands, let alone because of the state. As long as the Central Bank of Libya and the majority of the Tripoli militias are backing Dbeibah, there is no way that he will resign voluntarily.
But Zintan militias, which are supporting the parliament-appointed Prime Minister Fateh Bashagha, fortified its forces around Tripoli gates, while the Dbeibah militias are surrounding government buildings. Could that lead to an armed conflict in Tripoli?
Yes, the situation is very tense. Dbeibah has fired Osama Shweli, an influential general from Zintan, from his position as a director of military intelligence because he did not actively stop Bashagha from getting into Tripoli when he attempted to assume power on May 18. The Zintanis have during the last days moved most of their fighting force from the town in the mountains south Tripoli, including tanks, to bases in Azizia, south of Tripoli, and to their bases in Tripoli itself. The Nawasi Brigade, directly supported Bashagha during his attempt to assume power in May, have also mobilized all their forces. They are located close to Tripoli harbor. Also other militias like those from Rishfana have mobilized and are positioned around Tripoli. On the other side, the pro-Dbeibah militia coalition, the Constitution and Elections Support Force, what a nice name I would say, has increased its patrolling and checkpoint activities in the capital. The Amasik National Mobile Force, another pro-Dbeibah force, has mobilized close to the Zintanis in Al-Seraj and Janzur, also in the west of Tripoli. The Misrata have mobilized and sent some troops to eastern Tripoli. All the ingredients for some major fighting about the control of territory in Tripoli is there. Prime Minister Dbeibah is extremely nervous about the situation and has met recently with his Libyan Army Chief of Staff, General Al-Haddad, to ensure his loyalty. We will see during the next days what happens.
That was Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. The United Kingdom is planning to introduce legislation allowing it to ignore certain European Court of Human Rights decisions after a judge in Strasbourg blocked flights to take asylum seekers to Rwanda. Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab will bring the new Bill of Rights to Parliament today as the government attempts to implement its Rwanda plan aimed at deterring immigrants from making illegal crossings of the English Channel. Rights groups and church leaders have criticized the policy as shameful. British courts earlier this month gave the go-ahead for the first flight, but the European Court of Human Rights stepped in the last minute with an interim ruling to block its departure. Britain is battling record numbers of people using small boats to cross the English Channel from northern France. Numbers rose 68% in the first half of 2022, with 777 attempted crossings involving 20,132 people. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. As Ethiopia reels from the worst drought in the Horn of Africa in decades, residents in the northern Afar region are being forced to use dirty river water. Officials and aid groups can only provide water trucks when possible, leaving locals with new options. Halima Tumani reports from Afar region, Ethiopia.
This dirty stream stems from Ethiopia's Awash River, a lifeline for locals and their main water source for bathing, washing, cooking, and drinking. Ethiopia is reeling from the worst drought to hit the Horn of Africa in 40 years, and the northern Afar region is no exception. Clean water is a luxury many cannot afford, says Semera resident Aisha Ali. She says, "My children suffer from skin diseases and are always ill because the water we use is not clean. Some children even die because of this unsafe water." Khadija Hamida lives next to the river and says her children also suffer from illnesses and disease because of the dirty water. She says this is the only choice we have. All our children and families use this water. But it's not just villagers who are struggling with a lack of clean water. Dufti General Hospital, the only functional medical center in Afar, is overwhelmed with patients. Acting head Dr. Yusuf Muhammad says the hospital also is suffering from the clean water shortage.
Sometimes we may not get that water. Sometimes some elective cases are stopped or postponed due to lack of water. So surgical cases, surgical site infections are there because there's no adequate water. Attendants of the patients, some patients, they are using running water. There is a nearby river. They are using river water, which is not safe.
The Afar region's Water Bureau says it is struggling to address the water shortage and that it tries to provide filters. Fatuma Haisema works with the Afar Water and Energy Office. She says, "We have dug many boreholes, but we couldn't utilize them because of a shortage of fluoride." She says the fluoride level in the boreholes was below the WHO standard and we were forced to close the wells. The cost of filtering the water is high and beyond the capacity of our office. Relief comes when clean water is tracked in by aid groups and the regional government. Fatuma Omar, a resident of Semera, says the locals are relieved they can get tracked water. She says, "Previously we would buy water and carry it from the city center. One jerrycan costs about 40 cents, 20 beer. It was expensive and tiring, but now we get clean water, so this is good for us." The relief is only temporary. However, as the track quickly runs dry and people have to wait for the next one or are forced to risk using water from the river. Halima Othmani for VOA News, Semera, Ethiopia.
South Africa's main opposition party has criticized the energy minister's call to buy Russian crude oil to combat high fuel costs, but not because of Russia's war in Ukraine. Democratic Alliance lawmaker Kevin Milham said most of South Africa's refineries are closed, so there is no way of processing the oil. South Africa has been reluctant to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine, as Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town, South Africa.
Three times this year, South Africa has abstained from voting on United Nations resolutions condemning Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Now, South Africa's energy minister, Gwede Mantashe, has called for the country to purchase Russian crude oil, an act that would be a flagrant disregard of the sanctions against Vladimir Putin's government put in place by the United States, United Kingdom and European Union. Opposition Democratic Alliance lawmaker Kevin Milam says Mantashe's call is ridiculous.
Frankly, Mr. Mantashe's comments and calls for South Africa to buy oil from Russia are misguided. South Africa's refining capacity is at an all-time low at the moment, with the majority of our refineries shut down. So we have no way of refining oil purchased from Russia.
He says it's easier and cheaper to purchase refined fuel from refineries overseas like Singapore, the Middle East, Nigeria and Europe.
We've seen a massive jump in the fuel price hike because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. That's the first issue. The second is that our South African economy and the rand-dollar exchange rate is also unfavorable. And that's something that is directly attributable to government. Government has failed to run our economy efficiently. We've seen an average of about 1.5% growth per annum. And as a result, we're obviously an underperforming economy, and that's reflected in the rand-dollar exchange rate.
The South African government did not comment on Mantashe's statement. The Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, Naledi Pandor, has repeatedly said South Africa is not indifferent to what is going on in Ukraine, but thinks that as a matter of urgency, there must be a cessation of hostilities and that dialogue and diplomacy must be employed. Foreign policy analyst Zanusha Naidu of the Institute for Global Dialogue says she doesn't know what the solution to the high fuel price is, but the South African government should be doing more to avoid an economic crisis.
The fact of the matter is that South Africa has not done what it should have done at the structural level in terms of improving refining capacity, improving our own kind of capabilities, etc. We just haven't woken up to the idea that we could have downstream, upstream activities, because half of the problem is all politicized. It's all about politicization, this is a problem, that's an issue.
Mining analyst Peter Major says Mantashe's call to consider buying Russia's crude oil is an inane comment that ignores the plight of the Ukrainians and could reflect poorly on South Africa.
It actually could have detrimental effects. It could turn a lot of people's goodwill away from us here if the party keeps making statements like that. I mean, to be so biased, it's just crazy. Doesn't help the country, it doesn't help the people.
The Democratic Alliance is calling for taxes, which form part of the fuel price, to be reduced. Experts say the fuel price next month could reach an unprecedented $1.69 per litre. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Patrick Deya, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at